Secondly, I think you have to include your public relations departments and the people who do your public opinion polling into the decision-making process of your companies. The way I've seen it work, on the authority of internal memos, by the way, decisions are made on high, and your PR people are asked to put a good face on it. If they were consulted regularly before irrevocable corporate decisions, such as the location of a power plant, were made, just as you routinely consult with your engineering staffs and your legal staffs when making a big decision, I think you could avoid a lot of grief later on. Third, I think that all private companies in the power field should open up their board of directors and make them more visible and accessible to the public. Annual reports should be sent to all customers, not just to stockholders. There should be some institutionalized form of open planning, of regular input from an informed public. You should put women, not just more women, but women, on your boards of directors. They constitute a good percentage of your stockholders, more than half the public, and an even higher percentage of power users, yet they have no corporate voice at all in your industry. You don't have to necessarily wear a hair shirt and elect the state's top female environmentalist as a director, but you do a disservice to society by overlooking the many accomplished businesswomen, lawyers, doctors, and academic deans, such as of a law school, whose credentials are impeccable to serve as board members, but can't for some reason because they happen to be women. Do you have something to hide? That's the impression that comes across to us and to the public and to women. Fourth, I think you have to come up with more technological options, geothermal, solar, fuel cells, waves, winds, right across the board. The industry now appears to be frozen and rigid in its approach. And if you harbor any notions of a, quote, worldwide nuclear electronic economy, unquote, as was advanced in an advertising section of Fortune in June, they are politically, socially, and biologically unrealistic notions. More diverse sources will have to be at least developed as alternatives the public can choose from, or the public will take over your industry and do it for you. I think that is a choice you face. Lastly, I think you have to open your industry up to new blood. Recruit brighter young people into your corporations or your agencies. I know how difficult this can be. My brother is a partner of a large and prestigious law firm in New York. He went to Yale Law School last year to recruit and dangled salaries of $18,000 a year up to the best prospects, and they all turned him down. They were all going into public interest law firms. The best and brightest of our youth today are going into public service. I think this is laudable and long needed, but you have to convince them that the power industry is also a public service. However, to do this, you are going to have to be more responsive to the public. Just like us in the media, you are going to have to become more open and accountable. We should all throw our doors and windows open, and maybe we might just cool things off a bit without sealing ourselves from the outside world. Any further tendency towards polarization, isolation, or rigidity on either of our parts could literally be suicidal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Now, Edward A. Myers, Jr., Vice President, Southern Cal Edison Company.
Well, I guess we've established who the resident SOB is tonight. And I'd like you to know that my script has been submitted to our law department and has been duly blue-penciled, which has got to be one of the banes of our corporate existence, but it is a reality. Back in January of this year, the EEI, with a twinge of conscience, sought to see itself as others see it and commissioned an internationally known public relations firm to take a look at its public face. The conclusion was, and I quote, "Our utility chief executives are close-mouthed, uncommunicative, and intent upon maintaining a low profile. While their public relations executives were doing a poor job in communications, particularly regarding the environment, nuclear safety, the conservation of energy, and research. In fact, the only place where we rated any higher than Z minus was in the field of financial communications. So when you approach the problem of is there a credibility gap in the electric power industry, you have to come up with a conclusion that you bet your sweet bippy there is. But this is a country that's very used to gaposis. It wasn't too long ago that the big gap was the generation gap. And that was a period when there could be no understanding between the under 30 and over 30 members of the populace. They don't understand us, was the threnody of that time. Today, our baleful cry is, they don't understand us. And hence the credibility gap with the public who says, hey, we understand you, we just got our bill. Now, as utility people, we know our hearts are pure as the driven snow. But we're the only people who believe that. And of course, the real truth of the matter is that neither the utility nor any single segment of the public has a full understanding of what this future-shocked nation is all about. The issue of credibility, or lack of it, is not unique to our time, to our nation, or to our industry. But we who must produce, we who have to have it there when they flip the switch, are looked upon as mere custodians of the establishment and have become the focal point of a social revolution. Now, what's new about this credibility gap is that it is deep and virulent and reflects a growing disenchantment with a consumption-oriented Horatio Alger society and the ever more disgusting byproducts of our historical preoccupation with growth per se. And as a nation, we have yet to reach an accommodation of our newfound environmental sociological conscience with our continuing predilection personally to consume and demand more and more creature comforts. Now, no utility can answer the valid shouts of the public for conservation when its customers keep asking for more and more of the service that is the only reason we exist to supply. In other words, our institutions are in conflict with our aspirations. And that's the real credibility gap. We just happen to be in the middle of it. Now, you see, utilities really do think they exist to serve a public's demand for electricity. And more adversaries expect utilities to be the leaders of social change, barely recognizing that in the utility business, we are the stewards of billions and billions of dollars of other people's money dedicated to the service of our product. Many of the issues we face today are really not questions, they are challenges. Now, anybody in a responsible position, such as you are in a utility or an allied field, has got to recognize that in a short period of time, our nation has been beset by a host of ecological and sociological problems. Our skies are brown, our streams are murky, our landscape is littered. We're still reeling from the effects of the confrontations that brought an end to the most unpalatable war in our history. Our minorities are still struggling. Our poor are still poor, relatively so. And now, the massive uncertainties of the energy crisis all comes together at a time of cynicism engendered by Watergate disclosures. There's not a credibility gap, there's a credibility chasm. But if you read Webster's definition of credibility, maybe you don't have to wear this hair shirt and we can accept Larry's invitation to take it off. Credibility, entitled to confidence, trustworthy, reliable. The continuing and significant contributions of the electric industry and undergirding our economy and individual affluent lifestyle are too numerous to recount here, but they would indicate that we do merit the public's confidence. If you can accept the concept that attempting to give to our customers the best possible value for their money, which is the thrust of our business, if that's a measure of trustworthiness, then I think we qualify as trustworthy. And I know of no other product or industry that can claim a more reliable history of service. So in view of these obvious defenses, if we should indeed be faulted for lack of credibility, I think the problem can be attributed to the complexity of our situation and the rigidness of our institutions. We are not guilty of any overt or covert acts against the public weal. Here's an example of a credibility gap and the complexities of it. A few years ago, every indication was that Southern California was going to face a generating capacity problem. We based this conclusion on historical growth rates and acceptable forecasting techniques, and we did determine that we would need new facilities to meet future electric demands. In the background of our planning concerns for the future were things like long lead times for construction, projected escalation of labor, rising construction and money costs, rising concern about environmental protection and siting, land use controls, technological alternatives, all of these things. But in front was the historically based conclusion that, by golly, one day if we didn't do something, somebody was going to flip a switch out there and we wouldn't have any juice. Now, you may recall that we encountered extremely heavy opposition to any and all plans to expand those facilities. To help gain public support, we placed advertising which pointed out that we felt quite reasonably that if we were not allowed to build new power plants and utilize the new technologies that were emerging, there could in the future be a serious capacity and or energy shortage, and when and where this shortage occurred, there could be such things as blackouts. That was almost 7 years ago. And at that time, indignant customers were writing in condemning our big ads as scare tactics and misleading misrepresentations. Well, fortunately, the blackouts that we warned were possible haven't materialized yet. But we're not out of the woods. Some of those who still oppose our expansion plans can say, see, you were crying wolf. They really didn't need those plants. And we didn't, and we don't. Yet. Our credibility with the public suffers a setback under these conditions when actually unforeseen events of the time, such as fuel shortage, legislative new construction standards, regulatory imposed conservation, and other public changes have forced us to alter those early construction timetables. Well, of course, maybe there is some hope. Conservation is really only a finger in the dike of energy shortage, and we may yet be caught with our plants down. Now, this might improve our credibility, but based on the experiences of Eastern Utilities, I really doubt it. And the current furor over increased rates is going to grow. The public will sooner or later have to face up to the fact that the days of cheap energy are gone. It's a very unpopular thing to have to say. There just is no cheaper light at the end of the tunnel. Electric rates may well double within the next decade. They have doubled here in the last decade. As an industry, we have to find out effectively how to communicate this to people who don't want to realize this. As an industry working together, our record is pretty shabby because you see some are investor-owned and some are public power. Some are dual fuel and some are straight electrics. Some burn coal and some burn oil. And we haven't come together to face the total problem. Now, there are moves to unite the presently fractionated communications efforts of EEI, EEA, PIP, ECAP. But all the time this cauldron of alphabetical soup is bubbling, I haven't found any way to make rate increases that we feel is necessary palatable to our customers. The obvious conclusion is to tend to put the blame on somebody else. Look at those OPEC guys, those Arab sheiks. They raise the oil prices. Or inflation is eating us alive, or government policies. We really don't have them. or environmental restrictions, they really did it to us. Or your own insatiable demand for more and more goodies is what's really got us here. And truly, they've all played a real part in the raising cost of electricity, but we haven't told the public so in a way that they are willing to perceive. The only concern the average residential customer sees, and he's the voter, is when he is doing his thing by conserving energy, we are charging him more and more dollars for using less and less kilowatt hours. And I know that a massive advertising campaign is not right for this kind of a problem. Admittedly, advertising is one of the most commonly used communications tools, but it too is now suspect. In the times of rising utility bills, we think mounting a massive advertising campaign would be akin to waving a red flag at an already angry bull. Many customers even take exception to the legally required notices in their bills as an example of wasteful spending of money that could be used to reduce our charges. I think a better way is people-to-people communication. And we've been working at that and pinpointed over 1 million individual interfaces in a 2-year period. But with all these newsmen present, I guess I better comment on press relations, because that's really the key to the whole thing. These guys truly make or break us. I'd like to remind you, as you listen tonight, that the press views our world from their side of their eyeballs. And it's a different world that they see. They don't necessarily speak or understand the jargon of our trade. Newsmen working under deadlines appear to be abrasive to an executive more accustomed to asking questions than giving answers. And in any encounter between dissimilar personalities, there can be, and often is, a lot of friction. In some circumstances, an inquiring reporter seems to be a bone in the throat. That's when the law department cleaned up. A bone in the throat of the businessman who is more concerned with doing his thing, like getting that plant back on the line, than explaining why it went off. And he'd prefer not to give the answer because of the total complexity and required length of time to give the true facts of what happened. However, it has been our experience that when treated fairly, honestly, and openly, the press usually will give you a reasonably fair shake. And conversely, we found out that you can't and won't make points if you fend off any questions with no comment. If you don't know the answer, you should say so and call back with the information promptly as possible. Although the press doesn't like it, we have a standing regulation that press inquiries should be routed through the public information or whatever department you call it in your shop. There's a reason. Because in a company of several thousand employees, maybe you really don't know the right answer to a seemingly simple question. And we have got to improve on our total communication, but that's a reality of our life too. And there are valid reasons for not answering. And the lawyers aren't completely wrong here. We do have rules about being in registration for stock, and we do have concerns about proprietary information of vendors and a few things like this. But I'll tell you, in our house, we learned candor the hard way at San Onofre. And one of the quotations from our senior managers that now sit over each of our desks where we daily grind out the most detailed minutiae of what is happening at San Onofre is, "From now on, we'll report every sprained ankle." Now, I can't speak for all utility companies, but our experience has been pretty good. We set up a shop with 24-hour service 7 days a week for the press. At least one member of a corporate communication staff is on call all the time. And if something comes up, the dispatcher is notified first and the press guy second. Reporters are able to get an answer promptly and accurately most of the time. We hope it works. We are intertied with the other utilities in the West Coast on the same basis. We try to run the story down promptly and get back to the reporter with the facts, and it really is our experience that candor enhances our credibility and helps establish rapport with some members of the working press. Okay, what I've said is, you bet there's a credibility gap. And yeah, we really would be better off if we had, in the past, created a better understanding of our total business. But we haven't. Less than 2 people out of 5 even know how electricity is made or even know that it's a manufactured product, for example. Yeah, we'd like to successfully anticipate every issue or event of interest to the press, but we don't, and we can't. And yes, our public really should be convinced that we're the greatest, but the greatest convincer that they have is when they flip their switch, something good happens, and we're behind it. Yeah, the need for an intelligent solution to the long-term energy problem exists, and it does. And if we in this room are to be a part of that solution because we survive to do our thing, we cannot survive without a full confidence on the part of the public, and the bridge to the public is a media who understands our position. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. For a bit there after that comment about the legal department's blue pencil, I was afraid he'd gotten his script mixed up with someone else. Our next speaker then is Tom Harris, environmental affairs writer with the San Jose Mercury. Tom.
Well, the nice part about being on this part of the program is that the longer it goes on, the less there is for you to say that's new. So I can look at the program chairman and say I can easily keep within my time bounds because most of what I wanted to say has been said in other forms by other people. It is good for people in my profession to be here in this kind of a setting. I think it's long overdue, and I'm extremely hopeful that this mild beginning will lead to more of the same so that we can get on about the problem of solving solutions rather than being embattled in different camps. My job, like that of most of you here this evening, is never very dull. Last week I was interviewing the president or the vice president of Texaco Oil Company, and he was putting a problem to me that was somewhat different than the one that's been put to us here this evening and asking me as a representative of the press and the media what we could do to try and help the oil companies explain to the general public the validity of unprecedented earnings. Why doesn't anybody ever ask me something easy? And now tonight we're here on something of another purpose where people in your industry want to know what we can do to help you explain your need to get what Texaco has and you want. I just think your engineers have been looking at the wrong kind of pump storage. You guys have been pumping and Texaco has been doing all the storing. But I really would like to have someone tell me why the oil companies wait until their record profits before they come to us for help, whereas the electric utility industry waits until Standard & Poor's index of 35 drops 25% by mid-year. It just doesn't seem like very good timing to me. But I guess that's progress of a sort because it took you all of last year to drop that far. It does seem a bit irreverent, maybe just a bit, to joke about these kind of things, cash flow problems and generating the kind of capital investment that your industry needs. And it would seem, I'm sure, most unfunny, particularly to New York's Con Ed, which, as I'm sure all of you know, did not earn enough in the last quarter to pay a dividend for the first time in almost 90 years, and whose bond rating dipped so low to BB that they now cannot be touched in its investment by some of the country's largest financial institutions. So what can we do about that? Not too much. Probably more importantly, what can you do about it? Well, in the first case, as I say, probably precious little. We can talk about it. We can write about it. We can even editorialize about it. But in the long run, I think it's the pressure of rapidly changing economy in a somewhat chaotic marketplace and the salient reactions to both of those by people in your industry is what will make the difference between Con Ed's difficulties now becoming either a benchmark or an anomaly. I realize that what has been bad for Con Ed has not necessarily been all that bad for the rest of you, but I think that the capital investment attraction problems that they are having are quite substantial industry-wide. And it is said that yours is the most capital-intensive industry in the nation, spending $4 of invested capital for every $1 of revenue generated. Now, that sort of blows my mind. I used to play the ponies a bit when I was in a livelier time frame, and I could never let a 4-to-1 favorite get too very far away from me. You had to look at that rather closely. On the other hand, I don't believe I ever did lay any money down on a 1-to-4 favorite. The idea of betting $4 to get 5 back just somehow escaped me, and I perceive that perhaps that's the basic problem of your industry today, with your revenue generation the way it is. How you're going to convince a lot of people who have bucks to invest to come to you with that kind of rate of return is, I think, at the very heart of the matter. However, if you're going to offer a higher rate of return, that of course means that you've got to make more money from rates. And to make more money from rates, you have to get much quicker and much more supportive responses from all of the PUCs and all of the FPCs if we're going to avert some kind of a real crisis, not just the warm-up that we've been through in the winter of 73. I don't know whether that's possible at this stage of the game, but regardless of what anybody feels the credibility rating is, or the validity, or how long the opposition from environmentalists might last, I think the crucial problem here is, we got into this before we got here this evening, on getting wrapped up between problems on the short term and the long term, because they are different problems needing different solutions. And I think as we began to do there, almost throw up your hands, because the minute you suggest a solution, it might be fine for the long range, but it's going to kill everybody before we get there. But looking at the picture of needing a higher rate of return to get higher profits, to attract more capital so that you can build more plants, to give us more power, is not going to sit well with the average reader or viewer. Wait a minute. We've heard that song before, says he. Last week you were telling me that the nuclear energy industry is going to need something like $600 billion of capitalization between now and 1990. And the week before that, it was the coal industry that was talking about a modest $350 to $425 billion. And the week before that, it was the oil people who were saying the deeper we go, the more it costs, and we're going to need $500 or $600 billion by the turn of the century. Just how the hell much money is there to invest? He says, and maybe with good right too. Where is it all going to end? Without Washington speeding up the printing presses, perhaps to run off another issue of $100 bills, and if they don't get at that in a hurry, perhaps it'll be the first issue that ever went out that had the Speaker of the House on the bill. Perhaps a more important question to ask is, if we get all of the power you want to give us, what in the world are we going to do with it? What are we going to use it for? What are we going to make? And perhaps more importantly, what are we going to use for raw materials? If you think that we were vulnerable to the OPEC nations and what they put us through the past winter, then you better take another look at Mr. Park's Affluence in Jeopardy. And if you haven't read that book, it's high time you did. Because we're in a much more dangerous position on our basic natural resources than we have ever been or ever will be with oil. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that with the sharp downturn in the past few years in the birth rate, there are going to be a lot fewer customers downstream than some of the projections you've been working from. Well, you've heard a lot of questions tonight, and I guess we were really supposed to give you at least some answers. Here is one that I think is important for your industry to think about if it's going to seriously attack this maddening upward spiral of consumption and thereby, methinks, increase your public credibility, at least on the order of a magnitude or so. Pricing policies have got to change, and they've got to change now. The more you use, the more you pay per unit. Oh, I know, you're going to say, well, what's the difference? The customer always pays for it in the end. And I know my end is getting pretty tender, as is that of a lot of other people. And you're thinking also, now I can hear the response, click, and here it comes. The more we deliver to each customer, the cheaper it is to give it to him on a per unit basis. Volume buying and all of that business. Bunk. The great weakness in that theory is now, as it has been from the start, as your industry has never truly charged off the cost of depletion resource to anyone, bulk user or anyone else. I suppose because you didn't put it there, you figure you don't have to pay to take it out. Well, you do, or we do, and the guy who takes most of it out, whether it's wasteful or ignorant, is the guy who ought to pay the most for it. We cannot continue to externalize the cost of depletion resource as we have done in the past couple of decades. And I think that until your industry comes to grips with that central situation and employs a more realistic pricing policy,